Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We're reading this week from the year-end double issue. It's dated December 21st, December 28th, 2018. And it is the issue that we call The Faces of 2018. So it's kind of a year in review issue. We'll get two shows out of it. And as we typically do, I'll do the more current news this week and then go into some more of the year in review stuff next week. But I always look forward to the covers on the Faces of the Year. This one, the cover drawing, is set on the front steps of the Supreme Court. And in the foreground, you've got Judge Brett Kavanaugh standing next to Kim Jong-un. He's filling up a red party cup from a keg of beer, and Kim has one as well. The two of them are standing next to Donald Trump and Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. Donald's got a Coke in his hand, and he's getting a selfie with the Crown Prince and smiling real big. Let's see. Behind them, in the middle of the steps, Robert Mueller's looking on, and Michael Cohen is whispering in Robert Mueller's ears. Off to the left, kind of far away, Mark Zuckerberg is sitting on the steps, tapping on his laptop. And Theresa May, the Prime Minister of Britain, has tripped and fallen down the stairs and looks like she's got a big binder that says Brexit. We've got a few more folks up on the steps behind the gentleman. Two are, one's the young lady from Parkland. I think her name's Emma Gonzalez. She's holding a sign that says "How many more?" And the other is the is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the young Hispanic new congresswoman from New York. And the last figure on the steps, walking up towards the Supreme Court, is Melania, wearing that jacket they gave her a hard time for that says "I really don't care." It's hard to believe another year has gone by, but there we are, folks, the faces of 2018. And we'll start this week with the editor's letter. He says, "If there's a word that defines the year 2018, says dictionary.com, it's misinformation. An unintended consequence of the information age, misinformation and its cousin, deliberate disinformation, is a rising flood tide of lies, delusions, and blind adamant belief that imperils our ability to govern ourselves. The pollution pours in from Facebook and other social media, Russian troll farms, and a White House that denies that objective truth exists. Did Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman order the murder and dismemberment of journalist Jamal Khashoggi? Maybe he did, and maybe he didn't," President Trump said, shrugging off the CIA's evidence-based conclusion that he did. When asked why his client wouldn't testify in the Russia investigation, Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani explained, "Truth isn't truth." "There's no way to determine who's lying and who's not," Giuliani and his client insist. "Truth is inherently partisan. It's whatever you prefer to believe." To see where this leads, consider Vladimir Putin's Russia, the world's leading practitioner and exporter of Orwellian propaganda. In a chilling piece, The Washington Post this week examined how Russia is aggressively undermining the West's concept of truth. When the Kremlin was caught using a chemical weapon to poison a Russian double agent in Britain, Putin's disinformation machine pumped out a stream of conspiracy theories. Maybe Britain did this to make Russia look bad. After being bombarded with lies on state TV and social media, most Russians either believed Britain was behind the poisoning or said it could have been anyone. The goal of such propaganda, experts told the Post, is to create doubt about the obvious, to flood the zone with so many alternative explanations that people begin giving up on the facts. Sound familiar? This may be foolishly optimistic, but my wish for 2019 is that the word of the year will be truth. And that was from William Falk, the editor-in-chief of The Week magazine. And we'll go from there right into the first of two main stories, Trump's mounting legal jeopardy. What happened? President Trump was directly implicated in campaign finance crimes this week as his former lawyer Michael Cohen was sentenced to 3 years in jail after pleading guilty to arranging secret payments to two of the president's former lovers. A sentencing memo from federal prosecutors in New York directly implicated Trump, saying that Cohen tried to buy the silence of a porn star and a Playboy model to influence the election in coordination with and at the direction of the president, identified in the filings as, quote, individual one. Deepening Trump's legal jeopardy, American Media International, the parent company of the National Enquirer, also agreed to cooperate with federal prosecutors in the investigation. The company admitted that it made a $150,000 payment to buy the silence of former Playboy model Karen McDougal in concert with Trump's campaign so as to prevent her story from influencing the election. A separate sentencing memo from Special Counsel Robert Mueller's office revealed new details about the Trump campaign's dealings with Russia. Cohen, who also pleaded guilty to lying to Congress about Trump's attempts to build a luxury skyscraper in Moscow deep into the campaign, has provided useful information concerning certain discrete Russia-related matters core to its investigation, Mueller's team said. It was my blind loyalty to this man that led me to take a path of darkness instead of light, Cohen said of Trump at his sentencing. I felt it was my duty to cover up his dirty deeds. Trump dismissed the recent court actions, tweeting that Mueller's team had found no smoking gun, proving that he colluded with the Russians to win the election. In private, however, Trump has reportedly expressed concern that House Democrats may impeach him in 2019, with one official describing the past week's news as a reality tremor. Nevertheless, Trump told Reuters that he's not afraid of impeachment. I think that the people would revolt if that happened, Trump said. What the editorial said. If this is a witch hunt, as President Trump claimed, said the San Francisco Chronicle, it's the most productive sorcery crackdown this side of Salem. Despite Trump's best efforts to impede and discredit the ongoing investigations, federal prosecutors keep turning up more and more evidence of serious crimes in his inner circle, drawing ever closer to the president himself. No wonder Trump sounds increasingly frantic. None of what we just revealed is earth-shaking, said the Wall Street Journal. Yes, the Russians tried to insinuate themselves into the Trump campaign, but as far as we know, so far, nothing ever came of it. The Moscow Tower deal that Cohen worked on, for example, was quietly shelved. As for the porn star payoffs influencing the election, any sentient voter knew that Trump had a bad history with women. Mueller hasn't proved anything that resembles actual collusion. Lying about sex and paying to cover it up are wrong, but they're a long way from collaborating with the Kremlin to beat Mrs. Clinton. What the columnist said. If Trump weren't president, he probably would have been indicted by now, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. The president's own Justice Department just implicated him in campaign finance crimes for which Trump's lawyer is going to prison. But that's just one tiny molecule of the Titanic iceberg now bearing down on the SS Trump. We now know that at least 14 Trump associates interacted with Russian intermediaries during the campaign, contacts that Trump and his team have brazenly lied about. Imagine if voters had known that Trump was pursuing a development deal in Moscow, even as he was locking up the Republican nomination, or that Trump's consigliere, Roger Stone, knew in advance about the release of Democratic documents stolen by Russian hackers. In a weird way, Democrats are also in a pickle, said Jonathan Last in WeeklyStandard.com. Polls show that 77% of Democrats already want the president impeached. But party leaders understand that, with Senate Republicans unlikely to turn on Trump under any circumstances, impeaching him for anything less than outright collusion is at best risky and at worst suicidal. But if Mueller does present concrete evidence of more serious crimes, Democrats might not have a choice. Not impeaching a president who has committed crimes would mean that impeachment would essentially disappear as a functioning part of the Constitution. The 2020 election just became even more important, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. Justice Department guidelines prevent the indictment of a sitting president, but Trump could easily be charged with crimes the day he leaves office, leaving him with no choice but to triumph in the 2020 election or face the possibility of going to prison. There's simply no way around it. As long as individual one is on the ticket, the 2020 election is set to be a Banana Republic-style death match. And we'll read the second main story this week, titled White House Hunts for New Chief of Staff. What happened? President Trump's long-planned White House staff shakeup was thrown into disarray this week after his favorite to replace exiting Chief of Staff John Kelly unexpectedly took himself out of the running. The departure of Kelly, a retired Marine general who was hired last year to bring order to the West Wing but struggled to manage the freewheeling Trump, had been expected for months. The president and his chief of staff had stopped talking, but reportedly agreed last week that Kelly, 68, would announce his own exit. A day later, Trump broke the news himself, telling the press, "John Kelly will be leaving. I don't know if I can say retiring, but he's a great guy. Kelly will remain in the post until at least January 2nd. Trump said he would quickly name a replacement, and Nick Ayers, Vice President Mike Pence's chief of staff, appeared a lock for the job. He was backed by two of the president's top advisors, son-in-law Jared Kushner and daughter Ivanka Trump, who had repeatedly clashed with Kelly. But Ayers withdrew his name this week and announced he was leaving government at the end of the year. Trump pushed back on reports that he was struggling to find anyone willing to join the administration, tweeting that more than 10 people are vying for and wanting the chief of staff post. The top candidates are thought to include Representative Mark Meadows, Republican from North Carolina, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney. What the editorial said: Kelly deserves the nation's gratitude, said the Wall Street Journal. Managing Trump, who hates discipline, is an impossible task. Yet Kelly did that well enough and long enough that the White House could negotiate tax reform. Now Trump is without a helmsman going into the most perilous months of his presidency. Special Counsel Robert Mueller is circling. A Democratic majority House will soon launch an investigative onslaught, and a trade war with China must be resolved. Any volunteers? Trump's habit of appointing unvetted buffoons to key posts suggests the latest shakeup will only result in more incompetence and chaos, said the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Consider his replacement for Nikki Haley as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. The U.N. is no place for lightweights. Yet his nominee, current State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert, had no foreign policy experience before 2017. Her only qualification? She served as a personality on one of Trump's favorite TV shows, Fox and Friends. What the columnist said. Like many before him, Kelly departs Trump world with his reputation in tatters, said Michael A. Cohen in the Boston Globe. After becoming Secretary of Homeland Security in 2017, he served as point man for Trump's most egregiously racist policies, the so-called Muslim ban and the crackdown on undocumented immigrants. At the White House, Kelly helped sink a deal to protect young DACA recipients and publicly defended White House staff Secretary Rob Porter, who'd been credibly accused of spousal abuse, as a man of true integrity. Trump and Kelly deserved each other. No sane person would take the chief of staff gig, said Chris Steyer-Walt in FoxNews.com. For the position to work, the president must treat its occupant with an empowering respect and deference. But Trump trusts no one outside his own family and allows no one to act without his imprimatur. Ayer's refusal says much about where Republican insiders believe this administration is headed, said Matt Lewis in thedailybeast.com. The chief of staff position once bestowed an elite status and could lead to lucrative corporate jobs or a political career. But under Trump, it is an invitation to be humiliated, fired, chased out of restaurants, and maybe even indicted. Ayers knows a losing bet when he sees one. With Kelly out, all these so-called adults in the room are gone, except Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, said Mark Champion in Bloomberg.com. America's allies in Europe and Asia had relied on stalwarts, such as former Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, Chief Economic Advisor Gary Cohn, and National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, to constrain an unpredictable president. But they've all been ousted or jumped ship. And Mattis seems weakened, having lost fights over the creation of a space force and sending troops to the southern border. Now more than ever, Trump is his own man. Well, our controversy of the week is still political, but at least we change parties for this one. The Democrats facing chaos in 2020? The Iowa caucuses don't take place for more than a year, said Tina Nguyen in VanityFair.com. But already the Democratic street race to challenge Donald Trump for the presidency is well underway. The Democrats lack an obvious frontrunner, has a massive field of at least 20 and up to 40 potential candidates considering a 2020 run. To choose one nominee from this crowd, Democrats must first answer a series of important questions. Must the party pick a leftist like Bernie Sanders or California Senator Kamala Harris to inspire the base? Must the nominee be a woman and or a person of color? Or do they try to win back the disaffected blue-collar white males with a centrist like Michael Bloomberg, or a populist like former Vice President Joe Biden or Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown? At this early stage, said Andrew Henner in Salon.com, polls consistently show dinosaurs, Sanders, age 77, and Biden, 76, leading the pack. That's a problem. After a female-fueled victory of the midterms, with young Democrats now engaged and excited about the party's future, a battle of old white dudes could spell disaster. First and foremost, Democrats need an answer to Trump, said Edward Morrissey in TheWeek.com. He rode into office on a wave of anti-establishment populism, and it will be hard to beat him in critical swing states with a member of the Washington establishment. The Democrats need a candidate who can match Trump's outsider appeal. And whatever traction Biden may have with the white working class, his decades in Washington have left him with a terrible case of Beltway-itis. Hence all the excitement over Representative Beto O'Rourke, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. The charismatic Texan, who nearly upset Senator Ted Cruz in November, is being called the White Obama for his oratorical skills, even though progressives don't trust him because he hasn't embraced Medicare for All. At 46, O'Rourke offers all of Biden's sunny centrism without the age problem or the political baggage. The last thing Democrats need is another cautious centrist like Obama or Hillary Clinton, said Robert Kuttner in HuffingtonPost.com. It was their failure to stand foursquare with working Americans that allowed Trump to pose as a fake populist and win in 2016. If Trump makes it to 2020, said Elizabeth Brunig in WashingtonPost.com, he will be severely weakened. And there is a real opening for the Democrats to win with a candidate who has a bold, clear, distinctly progressive agenda. That must include a plan to combat climate change, regulate Wall Street, and make single-payer health care a reality. The Democrats are headed for chaos, said John Podhertz in the New York Post. In 2015, the huge Republican field of 16 candidates was a logistical nightmare that played right into the hands of a headline-grabbing showman like Trump. The Democratic field for 2020 will be even larger, and when women and candidates of color battle the white males for attention, accusations of sexism and patriarchal dominion will fly fast and furious, eclipsing serious discussions of policy. From my perspective as a Democrat, said Ronald Klain in the Washington Post, it's a plus, not a minus, that the party has so many viable presidential candidates. The whole point of primaries is to air and thrash out philosophical differences and determine which candidate fares best under pressure. In the battle to come, the man or woman who can triumph in that ordeal, not one who fits some set of pre-selected qualities, should be the Democrats' champion. So let's see what our good week, bad week segment has for us this week. Seems it was a good week for boldly going. After NASA's Voyager 2 spacecraft became only the second man-made object after sister craft Voyager 1 to enter interstellar space. The plutonium-powered Voyagers were both launched in 1977 and are very healthy if you consider them senior citizens, said project manager Suzanne Dodd. It was a good week for restocking your yacht. After the launch in the waters off Dubai of the world's first sail-through supermarket, selling snacks, drinks, toiletries, and other items to yacht owners and jet skiers. It was a good week for staying active. After a 102-year-old great-grandmother became the oldest person ever to skydive. It was very clear up there, said Irene O'Shea, after making the 14,000-foot jump from the skies over southern Australia. But it was very cold. Seems it was a bad week for automation after a robot at an Amazon fulfillment center this week accidentally punctured a can of bear repellent, unleashing a wave of eye and lung-searing concentrated capsaicin and sent dozens of flesh-and-blood employees to the emergency room. It was a bad week for goals after White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders told an interviewer that she hopes to be remembered as someone who was transparent and honest with reporters. And finally, it was a bad week for nervous flyers. after Delta Airlines announced a ban on passengers bringing emotional support animals on flights longer than 8 hours. Delta said it had experienced an 84% rise in unpleasant incidents involving support animals, including urination, defecation, biting, and even a widely reported attack by a 70-pound dog. And a short piece before we move from here. Kavanaugh Roberts back Planned Parenthood. The Supreme Court rebuffed efforts from Republican-led states to defund Planned Parenthood this week, frustrating conservatives who'd hoped newly appointed Justice Brett Kavanaugh would open the door to stricter abortion limits. Two federal appeals courts had ruled that Kansas and Louisiana violated federal law when they terminated Medicaid contracts with Planned Parenthood affiliates. The states asked the Supreme Court to intervene, but neither Kavanaugh nor Justice John Roberts joined the other three conservatives in voting to consider the cases. What explains the court's refusal to do its job here? Justice Clarence Thomas wrote, "I suspect it has something to do with the fact that some respondents in these cases are named Planned Parenthood." And we'll read a few of the U.S. at a glance news items this week. The first one comes from Torrance, California, called Nuns Gamble. Bowing to outraged parents, the Archdiocese of Los Angeles endorsed criminal charges this week for two nuns accused of stealing as much as $500,000 from a Catholic school. Sister Mary Margaret Krupper and Sister Lana Chang retired earlier this year from St. James Catholic School, where Krupper had worked for nearly three decades, most recently as principal, and Chang for 20 years as an eighth grade teacher and vice principal. A routine audit revealed that tuition, fees, and donations had been siphoned off for at least 10 years. The nuns apparently used the money for trips to Las Vegas casinos. They admitted to the theft and were placed under canonical restrictions by the Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet, which committed to repay the funds. "We've not been sleeping," said Debbie Rillinger, who put five children through St. James. "Sister Lana preached to those eighth graders every day that there are consequences to your actions." This from Washington, D.C. Russian operative. Maria Butina agreed this week to plead guilty to a charge that she infiltrated the National Rifle Association and ingratiated herself with Republican leaders on behalf of the Russian government. Arrested in July, Butina, 30, said she was a gun rights advocate who moved to Washington, D.C. in 2016 to attend graduate school. But after nearly 5 months in solitary confinement, Butina told prosecutors that she was directed by a Russian official to advance Russian interests. By agreeing to cooperate with prosecutors, Butina will likely avoid significant time in prison and could soon be deported to Russia. Yet the plea agreement lacked some of the explosive allegations made after her arrest, including claims she was connected to Russian intelligence. Russian President Vladimir Putin said this week, "I asked the heads of our intelligence services, and nobody knows anything about her." This is from Waco, Texas. Baylor rape charges. Jacob Anderson, 23, a former Baylor University fraternity president accused of rape, avoided jail time this week after pleading no contest to a charge of unlawful restraint. In February 2016, a Baylor sophomore said Anderson led her behind a tent at a party hosted by his frat, Phi Delta Theta, then gagged, choked, and repeatedly raped her. An investigation by the private Baptist school led to Anderson's expulsion and his fraternity's suspension, and a grand jury indicted him on 4 counts of sexual assault. Yet prosecutors say they lacked sufficient confidence to take the case to trial and offered a plea deal allowing Anderson to be placed on 3 years deferred probation while maintaining his innocence and avoiding having to register as a sex offender. After all these years and everything I have suffered, no justice was achieved, his accuser said in court. And from the world at a glance, we'll look at a few pieces here. The first comes from London. May's Brexit challenge. British Prime Minister Theresa May survived a major challenge to her leadership this week, winning a no-confidence vote called by members of her Conservative Party, angry at her handling of the country's impending exit from the European Union. May won the vote 200 to 117 after promising to not seek re-election in 2022, but to oversee the Brexit process and then step aside. "We now need to get on with the job of delivering Brexit for the British people," she said. But her troubles aren't over. Disgruntled Conservatives launched the challenge after May postponed a parliamentary vote on the Brexit plan she had negotiated with the EU, a vote she was certain to lose. Many Conservatives oppose the deal because of the Irish backstop clause that guarantees there will be no return to a hard border between Ireland, an EU member, and the UK, province of Northern Ireland. To achieve that, the clause says, the entire UK must remain in a customs union with the EU until some friction-free way of checking goods can be worked out, which could take years. A vote on the Brexit deal must now be held by January 21st, and May said she would seek assurances from EU leaders that the Irish backstop would not be indefinite. But European leaders were adamant that the agreement could not be reopened. The pound slumped briefly to a 20-month low against the dollar over fears that Britain could crash out of the EU without an agreement in March. That would cause trade barriers to suddenly be erected, potentially leading to shortages of goods and long pileups at ports. This is from Katowice, Poland. It says, U.S. lauds coal. The small U.S. delegation at the United Nations Climate Conference in Poland was heckled this week as it hosted an event extolling the virtues of coal, oil, and gas, the main sources of the carbon emissions causing climate change. President Trump's top advisor on energy and climate, Wells Griffith, boasted about the U.S. coal reserves and increased oil production and pitched technology to clean up coal plant emissions. All energy sources are important, he said, and they will be used unapologetically. The audience began laughing, and many stood up in protest, chanting, "Keep it in the ground." Meanwhile, the U.S. joined Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait, all major oil producers, in declining to endorse a recent UN climate report that found the world has only a decade to cut carbon emissions by nearly half to avoid catastrophic global warming. This is from Imakuni, Japan. Marines killed. 6 Marine airmen have been declared dead following a late-night collision off the coast of Japan between an F/A-18 Hornet fighter and a KC-130 refueling plane. 2 Marines were pulled from the water, but only one survived. 5 others were not found and were declared dead. It's the latest in a series of U.S. military air accidents that critics say are the result of wear and tear to aging aircraft after 17 years of war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and of budget cuts that have hit maintenance and pilot training. A Military Times investigation has found that the numbers of aviation mishaps rose 39% from 2013 to 2017, from 656 to 909. At least 133 service members were killed in those mishaps. This is from Tokyo. Immigrants wanted. Faced with a shrinking workforce and a graying population, lawmakers in Japan approved new legislation last week that will relax the country's famously stringent immigration laws. The new law will let in 345,000 foreign workers over the next 5 years, mostly to take jobs in construction, the hotel industry, and elder care. They will be paid the same rate as Japanese workers and will be allowed up to 2 5-year visas. Opposition parties condemn the law, saying there are no provisions for training or housing the workers or teaching them Japanese. But the country faces intense demographic pressures. The fertility rate has dropped to 1.4 children per woman, far below the replacement rate of 2.1, and the population is dropping by 400,000 people a year. Nearly 30% of Japanese are over 65 years old. The briefing page article has something of a Christmas theme this week. It's titled, The North Pole. As it melts, Santa's headquarters is becoming a geopolitical flashpoint. Where is the North Pole? Its exact location is surprisingly polarizing. There are technically 4 North Poles. The terrestrial North Pole is the precise point atop Earth's axis, a spot in the middle of the Arctic Ocean that is almost always covered with 6 to 10 feet of ice. The North Dip Pole, meanwhile, marks the spot where Earth's geomagnetic field points directly downward. All compasses point to this location. Because of the spinning of the planet's core, the Dip Pole is a moving target. In the past century, it drifted from northern Canada to the Arctic Ocean and is now moving toward Siberia. There's also the geomagnetic North Pole, the top of an imaginary line running through the planet's center, and North Pole, Alaska, a suburb of Fairbanks, about 1,700 miles south of the terrestrial pole. Why does Santa live there? St. Nicholas, a wiry 3rd-century Christian who used his inherited wealth to benefit children, lived in present-day Turkey. Yet, in the December 1866 issue of Harper's Weekly, the legendary cartoonist Thomas Nast drew a jolly rotund Santa Claus, listing his home address as Santa Clausville, N.P. Each year, the U.S. Postal Service receives hundreds of thousands of wish lists addressed to Santa Claus, North Pole. Nobody could have fact-checked Nast at the time he located Santa's workshop, as the remote pole, surrounded by miles of sea ice, had not yet been seen by human beings. Who got there first? Frederick Cook claimed to have planted an American flag at the North Pole on April 22, 1908, after nearly starving to death during a 3-month trek with 2 other men. Cook's success was immediately disputed, and many credit another U.S. explorer, Robert Perry, as the first to reach the pole the following year. After 7 failed attempts, Perry and 4 companions had traveled there partly by ship, finishing the journey on wooden dog-pulled sleds. Although front pages reported that the pole had been reached, later analysis of Perry's journey suggested he may have fallen short of the pole by at least 30 miles. The first expedition verified to have reached the pole was led by Ronald Amundsen of Norway, who flew over it in 1926 on a hydrogen-powered airship. Although dozens have since reached the pole unassisted, that could soon become impossible. Why is that? The icy path to the pole is melting. The Arctic is going through the most unprecedented transition in human history, says Jeremy Mathis, director of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Arctic Research Team. In fact, the northernmost latitudes are warming at twice the rate of the rest of the world, and there are about a million fewer square miles of sea ice there than in the 1990s. Last winter, the Arctic was 4 to 11 degrees Fahrenheit above average, soaring as high as 35 degrees in February. As ice melts earlier in the year, the expedition window shrinks. And if melting continues, it will release a catastrophic amount of carbon buried in the Arctic's permafrost layer. Melting begets melting. When ice becomes water, it darkens and traps more heat, and more ice melts. What's at the pole now? Not much, except a confusing number of flags. Perry declared the pole the property of the U.S., but nobody seems to have listened. Denmark, Russia, and Canada claim sovereignty over the pole, and the U.K., France, and Norway have also planted flags. In 2007, Russian explorers dove 2 miles into the Arctic Ocean to plant their flag on the seabed beneath the North Pole. This isn't the 15th century, said Peter MacKay, Canada's foreign minister at the time. You can't go around the world and just plant flags and say, we're claiming this territory. The reason there's so much competition for the pole is that the melting ice could create new, much more direct shipping routes across the top of the world between Asia and Europe, and between Asia and North America. The biggest prize, however, is below. The Arctic is believed to contain up to 90 billion barrels of oil, with a fifth of the world's natural gas beneath the Arctic ice sheet. Who gets it? It isn't clear. In 2008, five Arctic coastal nations agreed to settle disputes using terms set by the United Nations that entitle countries to an exclusive economic zone 230 miles from their coastline, and resources 403 miles beyond the coastline if they can prove their coast is an extension of the continental shelf. In 2015, five nations agreed to keep fishing fleets out of the Central Arctic Ocean so its marine life could be studied further, and no commercial fishing occurs there now. Yet with such precious resources up for grabs, the region is experiencing a military buildup, particularly by Russia. In 2014, Norway saw almost seven times as many warplanes near its coast as it did a decade earlier. NATO forces are training to fight in sub-freezing weather, although at the current rate of warming, Santa may soon decide to lose the coat. We'll read a few of the best columns. This first one from the U.S., Kushner's Curious Ties to MBS. Jared Kushner's bromance with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman should be investigated, said James Downey. The Saudis targeted President Trump's son-in-law and advisor just after the 2016 election, the New York Times reported this week, because of his inexperience, transactional attitude, and naivety about the region. Kushner, now 37, and Mohammed, 33, hit it off, with MBS, as he is called, promising to help Kushner broker an Israeli-Palestinian accord. The two princelings, in fact, became so chummy that they called each other by their first names and texted and phoned each other outside of official diplomatic channels. Kushner made at least two visits to Riyadh to privately confer with MBS, when the Saudis' autocratic leader apparently ordered the murder of dissident Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, Kushner gave his pal tips on how to weather the storm. Kushner has also become the prince's most adamant White House defender. Kushner appears to have been played. Given his personal friendship and private advocacy for a foreign dictator, why does Kushner still have a security clearance? When Democrats take over House committees in January, the sooner they subpoena communications between the pair, the better. The campaign to weaken the IRS. This is the golden age of rich people not paying taxes, said Paul Keel and Jesse Eisinger. Over the past 8 years, congressional Republicans have waged war on the IRS, cutting its budget and staffing so severely that it can no longer properly enforce tax law. The result is a bureaucracy on life support and tens of billions in lost government revenue. Last year, the IRS had 9,510 auditors, a reduction of 33% from 2010, and about the same number as in 1953, when the economy was a seventh of its current size. From 2010 to 2017, the audit rate dropped by 42%. Corporations and the wealthy have most benefited from the gutting of the agency, as their accountants and lawyers can devise aggressive tax evasion strategies, secure in the knowledge that the IRS is no longer a force to be feared. None of this bothers congressional Republicans, who decided to punish and weaken the IRS after it was accused of unfairly targeting Tea Party groups for tax enforcement. So even as the federal budget deficit soars, Congress is starving the agency charged with bringing in revenue. Does that make any sense? From Ireland, we have a united Ireland is within reach. It's time to talk seriously about reunifying Ireland, said Paul Gosling. Nearly a century after partition, the twin pressures of Brexit and demography have changed the political context. The only workable plan for Brexit that will prevent a hard border being erected between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, a European Union member, is for Northern Ireland to remain in the EU customs area. That would effectively shear the UK province from the rest of Britain, leaving the north bound closer to Dublin than to London. Meanwhile, in Northern Ireland itself, the Protestant population has been falling for decades, and Catholic and non-affiliated groups have been growing. So the pro-British unionist cause has less pull than it once did. Still, even if both sides want it, reunification won't be easy. Northern Ireland gets $6.4 billion in subsidies a year from London, and its public sector is bloated and inefficient. Dublin would have to swallow that bill and launch a program of reform. And since the Northern Irish don't want to give up British health care, which is free at the point of service, Ireland would need to remake its own health care system. We can't simply smash North and South together, but with a 10-year unification plan, we could finally achieve an integrated nation. And we're on the Talking Points page. First article is elections. Does the GOP fear democracy? North Carolina Republicans are no longer interested in what the voters think because they don't have to be, said Andrew Reynolds in Politico.com. As the state's population becomes younger, browner, and more liberal, the GOP is clinging to power by eroding democracy itself. Republicans there stripped authority from a new Democratic governor in 2016 and have drawn outrageously gerrymandered districts and imposed voting rules designed to suppress turnout of minorities. And now they just literally tried to steal a congressional election with malice, aforethought, and planning. The state's election board is refusing to certify Republican Mark Harris' narrow victory in the 9th House District, after it emerged that the Harris campaign paid a contractor with a criminal record to go door-to-door collecting absentee ballots, a felony in its own right. The contractor, L. McRae Dallas Jr., allegedly filled out an unknown number of blank ballots for Harris and destroyed others cast for Democrat Dan McCready. Harris then supposedly won the election by 905 votes out of 283,317 cast. Lo and behold, Democrats have discovered that election fraud is real, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. After years of fighting reform by insisting that voter fraud didn't exist, Democrats are predictably up in arms about the North Carolina race, where a new election now appears likely. The larger lesson is that people will exploit vulnerabilities in the election system, whatever they are. That's why rules governing voting should be as rigorous as possible. Another lesson is that expanding ballot access through absentee and remote voting can corrode ballot integrity, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Voter fraud may be rare, but there's no reason to make it so easy. Ballot integrity is Republican code for artificially preserving the power of their aging white rural voters, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. When all else fails, Republicans simply negate the results of elections. After Wisconsin's voters elected a Democratic governor and attorney general, the Republican state legislature just voted to strip the incoming officials of much of their power. In Michigan, meanwhile, said Joanne Sattler in the USAtoday.com, the Republican-controlled legislature is frantically weakening the incoming Democratic governor and blocking ballot initiatives that would guarantee paid sick leave and raise the minimum wage. All of this reveals a party that's terrified of voters, as it should be. Prison reform, a bill that reduces sentences. Finally, something both parties can agree on, said Charlie Kirk in FoxNews.com. America is locking up too many people for too long and spending too much money on them. It costs about $81 billion annually to house and feed the nation's 2.2 million incarcerated people in correctional facilities that often do not give them the skills they need when they're released so they don't return to crime. That's why most congressional Republicans and Democrats and President Trump all support legislation called the First Step Act. The bill reduces mandatory minimum sentences for some nonviolent offenders and implements educational and rehabilitation programs aimed at lowering recidivism rates. The bill easily passed the House, and after a frustrating delay, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell this week said he would call a vote before year's end. At last, Congress has realized more prison does not always mean less crime, said Bloomberg.com in an editorial. Perhaps most important, the bill will also fund research on what works and what doesn't in turning convicts away from crime. Reform is desperately needed, said Keith Watley in NYTimes.com, but this bill does far too little. The number of people eligible for the bill's provisions is shockingly small, about 4,000 in the federal system, which itself represents less than 10% of the U.S. prison population. It also omits prisoners convicted of violent crimes from reforms, when research shows they are most likely to benefit from educational and therapeutic programs that help them not return to crime. Sorry, but where is the evidence that we over-incarcerate, asked Rafael Mangual in TheHill.com. There is an enormous amount of crime that goes unsolved every year, for which no one is arrested or sent to prison. Last year alone, police failed to resolve almost 7 million serious property and violent offenses. That would suggest we actually under-incarcerate. When people are caught and convicted of crimes, said Jason Riley in the Wall Street Journal, First Step would give judges far more discretion in handing out sentences. Is that really reform? There's a reason judicial discretion was pared back in the 1980s and 90s. Judges were defying sentencing guidelines and releasing predatory criminals prematurely, creating revolving door justice. We all want to give deserving inmates a second chance, but not at the expense of the law-abiding poor who can't afford to move out of high-crime neighborhoods. And a few short notes as we wind up the program for today. Nearly one in two American adults have had an immediate family member go to jail or prison for at least one night, according to a study from Cornell University. One in seven adults has had an immediate family member imprisoned for at least a year. Total U.S. healthcare spending rose to $3.5 trillion in 2017, or about $10,739 per person, according to an annual report released by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Healthcare spending growth was 3.9% for the year, below the 4.8% rate in 2016. The U.S. Border Patrol arrested 51,856 people on the Mexican border in November, a 78% increase from the previous year and the highest level for the Trump presidency so far. Of those arrested, 25,172 were families traveling with children. On the poll watch, in a global survey of 152 countries, 15% of the world's adults, or 750 million people, say they would move to another country if they could. The U.S. remains the most desired destination, with 21% of potential migrants, roughly 158 million adults, saying they would want to move to this country. Canada and Germany are the second and third most desired destination, with 6% each. And we'll finish out with a quote from former President George H.W. Bush, who said, "Any definition of a successful life must include service to others." A good note to end on. And we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.